Welcome to another 3NR podcast. This is Scott Phillips, and I'm joined by...
Bill Batterman.
Roy Lefkowitz.
And... Maggie Berthew.
All right, so Bill, what's our first topic?
A little backstory. I went to the Samford University tournament this last weekend in Birmingham, Alabama. And instead of judging, I watched our sophomore teams debate. And they primarily debated other teams that were either sophomores or maybe a little bit older, juniors or whatever, that were teams that at a big national tournament would probably go 2-4, maybe 1-5. But kind of lower-end debates. And I saw a lot of troubling things, and I kind of wanted to talk about it and see if I could get your thoughts. The biggest thing was that it seems like a lot, like a bigger percentage than I can ever remember of the debaters just really don't have any idea what they're talking about in terms of the content of their arguments. So teams are debating about South Korea and have no idea the form of government of South Korea, who their president is, the history of the relationship between South Korea and the United States, you know, anything about North Korea. They're just sort of reading things that other people have cut from them, and they just don't know what they're talking about. It was particularly bad for debates about Afghanistan, debates about Japan. And I had a couple of thoughts about that, but I guess the first thing, and I'll ask if you all agree about this, is that I think that too many young debaters are pushed too fast to move beyond kind of basic just refutation and sort of case debating to start playing around with counterplans and dissads with big impact before they've learned just how to kind of just answer their opponent's arguments. And this kind of goes back to the flowing discussion we had last week and the various other discussions that we've had in the past. So, Scott, I guess I'll start with you. Have you noticed any of this trend? Do you think I'm right that it's getting worse, or has it always kind of been this bad? And do you agree that maybe some of our younger debaters are getting pushed too fast into more advanced arguments before they know the basics?
Well, I mean, there have always been kids who didn't know what they were talking about. I do agree with you, though, that it seems that, you know, particularly with, like, knowing what their affirmative is, that that's something that generally most people had some idea kind of what was going on there. But I think really the crucial issue there is the research, who's doing it. And I think it's much easier now to run an affirmative that you didn't do any of the research on because of camp evidence being openly available, sites like Planet Debate and CrossX and whatnot selling the files. You know, when I debated, we had the evidence that, like, of the camps we went to. But other than that, you know, you didn't get hundreds of files available on the internet. So if you wanted to run a different app, you had to do the research yourself. And so, you know, just even reading 3 or 4 articles about the issue will make you exponentially more intelligent speaking about it than having read none. So I don't know that it's so much that the types of arguments they're reading as much as the amount of effort they are putting into preparing those arguments. And so, I mean, you don't even have to read all the original articles, but if you just read through and highlight the Korea affirmative, you know, you'll know a lot about it. But now, even some camps turn out 2AC block files, so there's no need for the half to write their own blocks or figure out what the best evidence is or who's the best author on different arguments. And so I think that when they don't learn that early on, that kind of has a cascade effect and also really severely limits their growth potential, because if you don't kind of learn those fundamentals, you're not going to get it. In terms of the arguments that they go for, I mean, I guess the couple of areas that I've worked in recently all have kind of novice case limits-esque, where, you know, you can only read X, Y, Z affirmative. A lot of them, there was, like, no counterplans or critiques. And even in those areas with severely limited argument sets, you know, the amount of intelligent discussion about the issues going on, you know, varied widely from debate to debate, but was generally kind of lower than you'd expect. And you even see this at camp, like, kids who work on an AF but don't really get into it. When we then judge them in practice debates, you know, they know a lot less than kind of the other people that are going in, you know, the same group and theoretically should be doing the same kinds of research. So to me, it's really kind of a research question, I think. You know, if you debate or judge people who really do a lot of research, you know, the kind of, like, Lane Kershaw-esque, like, they always seem to know what they're talking about regardless of what argument they're going for.
I agree with you. I think that there's definitely a
a middle ground that needs to be followed, because the existence of the NBCA Open Evidence Project and all that evidence sharing means that everyone always has access to files, and I think that, I mean, I think everyone's guilty of it, and I'm not sure that it's a bad thing, but that we kind of, the focus has changed at least a little bit in camps in the last couple of years from solely evidence production to skill set development of being able to technically execute arguments and being able to, you know, go for dissads and explain DA turns of the case arguments, and that, you know, we haven't been as difficult on the kids in the amount of research they're able to produce. And I think that it's not just like us as lab leaders, but like even our kids who come back from debate camp say that they didn't do as much research, or they still have struggle with the research component of it, or being able to do good research, because a lot of what the camps did was more skills development, which is obviously very important. Being able to debate is one thing, but there definitely comes a point where there needs to be that middle ground that's like, you need to do enough research to know what you're talking about, and then be able to use that. It's not good enough if you have 60 practice debates if you don't know what you're talking about on that issue, but at the same time, you probably do need an abundance of practice debates to be able to execute in the debate round. So I think finding that balance, and it's like almost like that podcast, the NDCA podcast, when, I think we referenced this a little bit, but when, last time maybe, but in that Georgetown podcast, when Jonathan Paul and Will Repko were talking about that Georgetown debater, Anton, who was really, really good at cutting evidence but needed skills development, there's some of that where you need less skill, some people need less skill development and more research time, so you need to kind of figure out where your focus needs to be. If it's you're really good at line by line and really good at answering arguments, then you need to focus on knowing what you're talking about. And if you're really good at cutting cards, you need to get better at being able to execute. So there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to how you need to practice. You need to realize where your strengths are and then work on those.
I kind of disagree. I think in general that like there is a one-size-fits-all, and it's called you should practice speaking on your own, and when you interact with a coach, you should be talking about how to make good arguments and research them.
Right, but you should be doing both. I mean, we don't disagree. You need to do both, but sometimes people focus on one and not the other.
I feel like, to some degree, there's sort of a cult of the rebuttal redo. The idea that if we just practice this 1,000 more times, our arguments will become magically better. And I think that what's lost there, and obviously rebuttal redo is important, is that knowing more about your arguments helps you develop them within the debate. And sometimes I think the debaters that do really well know so much of the backstory that almost that implicit knowledge becomes a part of what they're saying without them even realizing it. And I think that those are the debaters for whom so much of the argumentation seems very natural, because they understand the arguments and are very comfortable with them. And instead of trying to memorize or develop a particular set of blocks that will magically make things happen in the debate or refine, you know, what you're going to say in the 2AR, they're really working to figure out what the argument is and what these authors are actually saying, and those connections then become a lot easier for them over the course of time.
Yeah, I can't imagine debating the way that some of these debaters do, where it just seems like they're totally unfamiliar with the literature about their affirmative or about the case that they're debating. One thing that I think I would be interested in, I've never tried this, but I would be very curious to see if debaters could give speeches in debates without reading any cards and fill up the time and actually make arguments. So if the 2A is on a team that reads the Afghanistan affirmative, the 1NC just reads, you know, the normal arguments that they would commonly hear, the Taliban takeover dissad and a counterplan to, you know, do something to solve stability, whether the 2A could verbalize the arguments that their cards would be making without actually reading the cards. Because it seems like so many speeches at this kind of mid-tier or lower-tier varsity level are just walls of cards that no one in the debate understands at all. And it just kind of, it also goes back to the problem of flowing. Nobody's even really paying any attention. They're just like looking at the speech document, and it's a bunch of cards, and no one ever talks about like the arguments. They just talk about the tags and the existence of those cards, but not the arguments. But obviously good cards are important, but it just seems like too many debaters just read cards and don't make arguments.
Well, I think that also it's like good cards serve good arguments, and so being able to even tell which cards are the good cards or which card helps you comes only when you know the arguments. And so, you know, it may seem counterintuitive what you just said, that we should be using fewer cards in order to understand our evidence better, but I think that what you've said is exactly right, that the better that they understand the arguments requires reading a lot more in the literature.
Well, I think that high school, and this goes back to something Maggie said a little bit ago, that in high school it's a little bit different than college debate, in that with last year with Pesci, the thing that I thought was more important was that he knew the issue, that he was researching a lot better. Like, we found that in some debates, even if someone, you know, someone else had done the strategy, if he didn't know the strategy as well, like, prepping that strategy took a lot longer. But it was almost probably, we probably had a better chance of winning the debate if the strategy maybe that he did was a little bit worse than the strategy someone else did. But him doing the research means that he knew the things that he was talking about. And I think that in college, at the top levels, like, you can, you know, there's some debaters who can just pick up a file and just use it without knowing what they're talking about. But in high school, you know, doing that work is really important because you don't have that skill set to kind of execute or BS your way around it. So, you know, at the top levels, you don't see, like, the Kershaws, the Markovs, the, you know, the Pescis, the last year doing that stuff without working. You know, they were the ones who did a lot of those strategies. It's not something that's just fed down to them, and you can tell in the way in which they're debating that it's not just something they're regurgitating, that they seem to have done a lot of the research on those issues.
Well, I think we've kind of conflated two issues here. One, it's obviously important to know what you're talking about. But two, just like the analytic argument seems to have died as like the category of something that's credible. And so whenever I see a 2AC make an analytic argument, it's rarely longer than perm do the counterplan. That's like all they say. And so,
or non-intrinsic.
Yeah, with no explanation of what that is. And I think that there's kind of, you know, a chicken or the egg thing. There's this belief that judges won't vote on arguments if there's not a card to it. But that belief comes from making really short, crappy arguments, and then the other team having four cards on it, and the judge being like, well, I voted for the team that had four cards, because they read someone who was making a well-formed thought that was better than her new counterplan. And so I think that, you know, Bill's idea of can you make the arguments without evidence is pretty good, because, you know, is it really that big of a difference, you indicting the idea that cutting and running from Afghanistan would hurt our credibility being stupid, or like Evo Dalder saying the same thing? It's like, unless your evidence is making some kind of like statistical or empirical argument that you need a lot of like authority, or like you didn't do the model yourself, you know, you can generally explain most of those things, I think, pretty well. And I guess the one example of that where it's kind of like maybe taking too far the other way is like teams who are pretty good on the critique oftentimes just end up like BSing a lot of stuff, because, you know, it's not really either Roy babbling or him like reading a Zizek card. It's like there's not a big difference between the two there. And so I think that should, like, you know, stand as a pretty stark counterexample of why you don't necessarily need a card. It's on everything. But also, it's just like, when you're reading evidence, it should be because you know a lot about what's going on and why that card is good, instead of just like, they read a dis ad, now I must read a bunch of evidence to respond to this.
And I think that's really, you can do that really easily on, like, politics days and stuff, like analytical arguments that force people to read a card, like an impact defense indict, or just like, you know, saying like a couple reasons why your uniqueness evidence is bad, or like a no internal link argument, or places that even if you might not win the debate round on it, you will force them to read one or two cards on that will get you, you know, net positive time in the block. And I think that we were talking about this in our debate office last week, which was just like having just like a core number of arguments you want in the 1NC, you know, through analytical arguments, and also just like it's the same thing for the 2AC. Like, if the 2AC is just pieces of evidence, like six cards, that's a lot easier for the 2NC to stand up and pull out answers to X, answers to this, answers to this. If you've got analytical arguments, that means that your 2AC block has gone from like 6 to 11 answers. They might not go for this now. It changes a lot of that, but I guess like just like flowing, it's like a dead art, you know, just like inserting analytical arguments. And it seems logical that you could take, you know, make a smart, you know, if you're not straight turning a DA and you're link turning it, you know, you got your uniqueness arguments, your link turn, make a no internal link, make your impact, you know, a couple impact defensive arguments there, and then just kind of mix up the 2AC. Don't just be like non-unique, non-unique, link turn, move on. Right? Like, that's the block. That's what the 2NC wants you to do. And that's probably why AFs lose a lot more debates, because they don't really think about those stuff.
Well, I think Bill's post about climate is an interesting example of where the, like, knowing what you're talking about and making an analytical argument can be very effective, because if the team gets up and just reads a laundry list style impact card that's like, U.S. leadership is key to stopping Japanese prolif and reassuring Germany and stopping war in Europe. Oh, and by the way, climate change too. You know, in response to that, I think a lot of teams would be like, this card is bad, and move on. And that you're going to lose. That's not an argument. So in that instance, judges are going to privilege evidence. But if instead you said, you know, this evidence is warrantless, it gives climate change as one of a list of things without any explanation of what we do to solve climate change. Empirically, even the U.S. has not been able to ratify Kyoto or adopt cap and trade or any of the things that would feasibly solve climate change, despite hegemony being high, let alone convince, you know, China and India to also do those things. So there's no chance they solve this. And then take it one step further and say, you know, this evidence does not provide a warrant, so analytic arguments that do provide a warrant should be privileged over just kind of like, this person is an expert, so we'll take their word for it. And if you say something like that, you know, there's like 0.001% of judges in the country who are going to look you in the face and be like, well, they had a card. Because you've actually explained not only your argument, but why is your argument better than the kind of crappy card that they've read. And I find that, like, nobody is willing to go that, like, extra step because they're so afraid that it's just, like, wasted time. So they just roll out, you know, ecosystem resilient, blah, blah, 94 in response to warming. And that's just, like, a terrible approach. So anytime you debate a laundry list like that, just kind of, like, dissecting it, give a couple of empirical examples of why it's true off the top of your head, which, again, you have to know something to be able to do. But then the 2AC can't beat that argument without reading additional evidence. It's just impossible because they can't give compelling counterexamples of how we did solve climate change with leadership because it's never happened.
I think... No, okay, well, I was just going to say, the speech that the 2AC, sometimes people make analytical arguments, usually they're short and terrible, but the speech that really doesn't make analytical arguments anymore, which I don't understand, is the 1NC. I can remember not terribly long ago, I guess. I mean, maybe it's longer ago than I can remember, but 1NCs, there would be like an analytical argument and then a card, and then an analytical argument and then a card. And those analytical arguments were often pretty important. And this weekend, we stayed and watched a quarterfinals debate, and Mountain Brook, Lee Quinn, and Evan McCarty were negative against an AF that had some like pretty obvious holes and sort of like alternate causalities, reasons that the plan probably didn't really solve their advantages. And instead of the cross-ex of the 1NC was good, and then instead of it just ending, which is what happens in every debate I can remember, the 1NC began each case flow slowly kind of connecting, here's why this advantage doesn't make sense, here's why they can't solve their advantage, or here's why their advantage is empirically denied. And they ended up just like obliterating the case, even though they didn't really have very much evidence to read on the case, just because they made some intelligent arguments. And I just don't understand why people don't do that more often, especially when 2ACs on the case, which is something we're going to talk about later, tend to be so horrible. They just kind of like group everything and extend every 1AC card by citation without ever saying anything. And so I think judges are going to be a lot more amenable to a 1NC that's like clear and makes some smart arguments and then develops them in the block, because the 2AC is certainly not like insurmountably intelligent about most of this stuff.
Well, think about it like this. There should be more analytical arguments, and I guess ask yourself this question. If you are the 2N, or if you're the, even whoever it is on the negative, someone during the 1AC should be looking at the 1AC, and you're going to set up some cross-ex questions. So presumably, you're going to be writing things down to ask. Use those questions, which will probably be half-decent, and translate those into analytical arguments. So whoever is going to be writing out the questions, probably the 2N, depends on who's prepping. Now, during the 1NC, I don't know what these 1As are doing, right? Like, a good 1A during the 1NC is reading the off-case arguments, has a sheet of paper next to him, and is writing down cross-ex questions. And those cross-ex questions, like uniqueness problems with the politics DA, link problems like with like when the link is from or how old it is or what it talks about, impact defense problems, those written out arguments should be translated into analytical arguments for the 2AC. Like, you could literally hand your partner the sheets of questions that you ask those, and then at the appropriate spot, those become analytical arguments. Because even in good cross-exes that we see, that doesn't get translated into speech time. It's like, a lot of the cross-ex is like really good, and then you're the 2AC, and the 2AC wasn't listening to the cross-ex and doesn't translate that. So if you're a 1A, you should be writing down analytical arguments that the 2AC can use if the 2A is too busy to prep.
Well, let me add one thing there, because I'm not quite sure if I'm going to be disagreeing with Roy here, or if he agrees with me, but, like, I'm getting really tired of the this portion of your evidence says X style of cross-X, where I guess I'm just, like, old, but the purpose of cross-X is not to make arguments. It's to, like, get some kind of clarification that sets up an argument, or to, like, trip up the other team into committing to something that's, like, stupid for their strategy. And instead, what you see a lot is, like, I've looked at your 1AC evidence, and now I'm going to ask you a string of questions. Doesn't this word in the Calzot evidence contradict this? Okay, now in this Kagan piece of evidence, this one ununderlined sentence says this. Okay, and so first of all, never is the other team going to capitulate and be like, oh my god, that was a terrible card, we shouldn't have read it, strike it from the flow. Okay, they're going to give some like nonsense explanation. So it gets you nowhere. Occasionally, reading the ununderlined piece of evidence in a cross-X is good, only after you ask them a previous question that gets them to say something that portion of the evidence then unquestionably contradicts. When you just lead with, what is the part of this evidence, how does this work, you know, then it gives them way too much wiggle room to just make nonsense. And so then the ask gives their nonsense, and then the neg is like, oh, okay, that's fair. And then the argument never reaches into the speech. So it's like, if there's a problem with the evidence, that's a 1 in C analytic. It's not like the entire cross-X. Your cross-X should be strategic.
Right. I agree. I don't think that we disagree too much, but what if, like, a situation like this is how I envision it, is like, politics uniqueness cards are usually horrible. The 1 in C is tagged, start, will pass now. Obama's political capital is key. He's pushing it, or something like that. And the quote says, like, the quote of, like, the card, the best part of the card is, like, Obama says he thinks, I think start will get it through, I think Congress might get it through. Like, you know, no vote count, nothing like that, just like Obama pushing it. Cross-X questions are about, do you have any evidence about a vote count or anything? Is it just like Obama, who obviously supports START, saying that he thinks it's going to get through, right? Pointing that out in the cross-X and then setting that as an analytical argument up.
But what does bringing that up in the cross-X accomplish that in the 2AC saying no vote count?
In the cross-X, they have a chance to, like...
Yeah, it just gives them free speech time to be like, oh, well, you have to look at that through the lens of our internal link evidence where the M2 press wire brilliantly analyzes. It's like... It's just, I hate questions that let the neg do the explanation they would otherwise have to do in the block. And so if you ask that question and then make the argument,
so where do you
then
want
the block would be like,
where do you want the questions to go around, like, on that, on like that DA? So it's like,
well, if it's a bad internal link card on politics, I think that lends itself to questions about, like, what is the link threshold, basically. So if it's kind of like Obama speculating about it's going to pass, or, you know, it doesn't use the phrase political capital, but it says, like, arm twisting or something along those lines, then I would ask a question and I would say, okay, so your internal link argument is Obama can't twist arms on two issues at the same time. And they have to say yes. Then in the 2AC, you read a piece of evidence, Obama pushing XYZ other issue, if that makes sense. So it's like, the question should set up the argument, not, like, broadcast so much what the argument is, I guess. And, like, I think the problem is that it's, like, that actually, like, requires some thought, and it's much easier to be like, oh my god, I see this card as bad. I want, like, a cookie for figuring this out, which is, like, the immediate gratification of reading it in cross-X, I guess. And so
I think it also goes back to knowing the evidence and knowing the arguments, that it's a lot easier to pull out a card and point out that somebody's unqualified or this evidence is old, because that requires no background knowledge. The kind of cross-ex that you're describing requires some background knowledge of the relationship between the arguments and what arguments you might want to set up. And so I think that part of the reason that so many cross-exes are based only on this is the evidence that you just read, I'm going to go card by card through it, is because there's not enough background knowledge to figure out what you could set up. And that, to be honest, is, you know, difficult to do. So no, complaints about people who are still working on that. But I do think that that's one of the big differences between people who are sort of at the beginning of their varsity debate career and people who have reached the top of it, is that they have enough knowledge on those issues to be able to set up a really good cross-ex.
I'll be honest, at this point, cross-exes are so bad that I don't mind people pointing out that evidence is bad, because it's a
step up. It's often better
it's
than
a, it's a step up from what we're getting now.
Could you please mark all of the things you read in all of your arguments?
I want you to re-jump all of the cards in a different order than you jumped in the first one.
Yeah, the speech that I got was not in the exact order in which the 2AC was given. Is there a possibility that you could read through the whole 2AC?
Can I get the full text of all your analytical arguments?
Can you mark which conditionality answers you read?
I mean, I guess, like, I think there's, like, so much pressure on people also that they think they have to have, like, a brilliant cross-ex, that they oftentimes just don't ask, like, obvious crap. So, like, For example, if I was debating someone who was like leadership, sauce, climate, laundry list, and then Tikal, the first thing I would ask in cross-examination would be like, what does leadership do that prevents a 4-degree rise in temperature? And that's like, that advantage is over at that point, because like, what could the AF possibly say that would explain how that would work based on the two pieces of evidence they've read? And so you don't even have to have knowledge, but just like trying to get the other team to demonstrate knowledge will often be enough to make you look awesome in cross-ex and make them look pretty bad.
I think that that's something that people unnecessarily shy away from. I think part of this comes from when coaches are trying to get people to transition away from the novice, like, can you tell me everything you just said in your own words, to asking strategic questions.
Can you explain the plan in your own words?
No. Those words were used in the plan. I need different words.
I need new words. Not those words. Try these words. I think that the part of the fear, though, is that then you stop asking people to explain what they just said. And I think that if you do sort of what Scott just described and pick an actually weak place of the affirmative, sometimes asking them, or the negative, asking them to describe that really does point out that the arguments that they have made do not meet the standard of argument. But that's something that people sort of shy away from because it seems so close to what you know that you're now not supposed to do. Please tell me everything that your advantage says in your own words.
Well, I think also that, you know, kind of going with this, like, critique post that I did, part of the reason that I think people rely on these kind of, like, stock regurgitated questions, like, who is the agent and, like, blah, 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 is because they don't want to look dumb by kind of just saying, I don't understand what this says. Explain it to me like I'm a 4-year-old. And I think that's a much better question to ask than who is the agent, because
you should never ask who the agent is.
Well, because it kills your ace background.
Yeah, it kills your ace background.
But it's like, you're not, who the agent of the alternative is not oftentimes the central question. It's like, how broad is it, and what does it do to kind of rectify whatever the problems they're isolating with biopower or whatever it is. And so I think just saying, you know, when someone reads an alternative text that's like, you know, resist the 1AC biopower, I would just be like, what does resist 1AC biopower mean? And the neg is going to give you some nonsense like, oh, well, the ballot. Vote. It means the ballot. And I would say, what piece of evidence do you have that advocates using the ballot to resist biopower? And they'll be like, oh, well, of course our card doesn't say that. And then I'd be like, then of course your alternative doesn't solve anything. Like, it's over at that point. But people instead are like, do you fiat it? Who's the agent? What's the framework?
And it's like, the plan possible in the world of the alternative?
So it's the five people in this room? Or just the judge?
Is the plan possible is my like least favorite question, because all you're saying is like, is it plan inclusive? But saying it in that manner, like, I guess makes it sneakier? I don't really know. I would just say, is it a pick? Like, I don't understand why people word it that way. But I don't want to get off on a rant here. That's Roy's territory.
Roy's
but like, honestly, in cross-ex, if you don't understand something, just ask about it. Don't use some kind of like tangential, you know, diagonal approach to get at the heart of the issue. Just say you don't understand it. And I think that's particularly true like when you debate critique apps or apps that like don't have a plan. I think in the 1NC you can just ask a bunch of questions about framework, for example. Like, I always used to ask teams like, what negative arguments can we read that you won't contest the link on? And either they'll be like, what? Because they're like so shocked. Or they'll give you a list of just total nonsense that, of course, you would never be prepared for. And then you know already what their 2AC argument is going to be, so you can start writing out your explanation of why that's bad ground.
Yeah,
I think also people are a little too afraid to look stupid in cross-ex, and that translates to looking stupid.
Guys, don't worry about that. You all do a really good job of that.
You'd rather look like a dum-dum in cross-ex than in, you know, the 2AC or the 1NC. So I guess, if you're going to not understand the argument, I'd rather you not understand it for 3 minutes in cross-ex than for the 5 minutes of the 2AR.
Yeah, I think too many people, cross-ex is just all about posturing. And sometimes it can be sort of impressive when you can deconstruct some AF cards or some NEG cards or whatever. But for the most part, you're not really accomplishing anything, and it gets old pretty soon. And the worst part is when younger debaters don't really know what the debate is about or don't really understand the arguments. And instead of figuring out what the arguments mean and having a discussion about just kind of the reasons on both sides, they try and mimic the style of cross-ex that they see the best debaters doing. They're just like, you know, this card's old, right? Or this card says the opposite, right? And it's just horrible. And then when they get in their speech, their partner or themselves don't know what the argument is about. So, like, if you're the Afghanistan AF and you're debating the Taliban takeover dissad, I think it's probably better to ask, you know, why will the Taliban take over? What parts of Afghanistan would they take over? What part of Afghanistan do they control now? Why would taking over more of it be worse? And then just have a debate about the reasons for the argument than being like, your evidence concludes that they won't take over the whole country. Doesn't that mean you lose your whole dissat or whatever? But the cross-ex is, I think this is another example of, at the top, kind of the questions like Roy described, the more of the like posturing questions can be helpful or at least partially helpful, but when those get mapped onto or like trickled down to the lower debaters, it's really bad.
You're listening to the 3NR Podcast, podcast.the3nr.com.
I wanted to see if we could get some tips for the people that are listening to this who are thinking, gee, I hope he's not describing me. I'm probably one of these lower debaters. I don't want to be bad at debate. I want to be better at debate. But it seems really hard. What can I do to kind of bridge the gap? And I guess there are a couple things that I've written down. I guess I'll just throw one out and then any of y'all can add something. But I already said to practice kind of giving speeches without cards so that you can, the kind of basic test should be, you know, if you're the 2A, can you explain your case? Can you explain the arguments that you're making? Can you explain your responses to the major negative positions? If you're negative, likewise for your negative arguments. But I think that you should consider, you need to master kind of the content of a given set of arguments or a given issue. So, like, you need to master the Afghanistan issue to a basic level before you should ever start experimenting with things that are more advanced. So if you don't understand anything about the Afghanistan affirmative, you need to learn about the Afghanistan affirmative before you start going for the consult the Joint Chiefs counterplan or whatever. Because prioritizing the, you know, incremental increase in wins in the short term at the expense of actually learning about debate in the long run is gonna retard your development. And I see too many debaters who really have some potential, but they're just relying on arguments that don't require them to think. And so as a result, they just kind of continually stagnate. And, you know, they'll be at the Sanford tournament next year and going 3-3 or whatever because they're not really challenging themselves to get better at debate. Roy, you got a tip for the youngins?
About just getting better at debate in general.
How do you get from the 2-4 bracket at Sanford to the 3-3 bracket at you know, Michigan or something like that?
Well, I think
playing.
I think something that we were talking about today in practice was that you want to keep things simple, and I think that what that means is that people tend to, these debaters try to, like, overcomplicate their lives and what they're doing, and I think that you have to have a strong foundation in order to, like, get better at debate. Like, you have to know some core basics and be good at stuff, and, like, there is a learning curve that means that you should not be trying to do some of the things that your, like, highest-level debaters are doing and imitate them, right? Like, the top 10% of teams can get away with a lot of stuff that the bottom 90% cannot get away with, or even that the middle cannot get away with. So I think that getting comfortable at going for deterrence in the case, right? Go for that a ton of times, or deterrence in the case and the counterplan, and just practice going for that. And don't take, like, a shortcut out that might help your win percentage in the short term. Some of the reasons we had Jason and Raheem read the broadband app last year was not because we thought the broadband app was really good, but it was because it was a big, popular app that a lot of people had stuff to say against, and that they were going to have to debate that bigger app. And they asked last year, they're like, can we read something that's a little bit smaller that people aren't as ready about, and it wasn't, last year wasn't about getting them to the, you know, the TOC or to, like, the elims of the TOC, it was about getting them to that solid foundation. So if you kind of take shortcuts to try to get short-term success, that will cut your ability to get better off in the long term. So it's like, it is okay to be mediocre for a while, as long as that mediocrity is, you know, in improving the skill set that you have, and not trying to find ways just to maximize the number of wins. If you're a sophomore, or if you're just, like, starting your junior year, you're probably not in a position where you're going to be in the late elims of a major TOC tournament. So rather than set a goal that you will not achieve and do something crazy and not be good at debate and be a total joker, practice getting good, and maybe you'll hit that curve a little bit later on in your career, but you'll get there eventually, whereas if not, you're just going to be mediocre forever. That's one thing.
I think the sort of...
I also wasn't listening to the question.
Or what Bill said. I think that the sort of summative thing for what Roy just described is to invite clash, which means that you want as many opportunities for people to make good arguments against what you've just said as is humanly possible. So that sometimes means not going for theory and taking the hard fight out on, you know, like beating the counterplan. It often means not going for topicality when you could go for the dissenting case, or not going for a counterplan that even solves a bunch of the case, because you're, you know, learning good dissent skills. I do think that there's a lot to be said for the dissent. And I think that a lot of the sort of skills that you need to learn to be good at debate and be able to think about a whole debate, a lot of them come about just from practicing dissent and case debates. So I'm a big fan of this. I'll also put in a plug here for being nice. There's sort of what I consider the, yeah, okay, but the, like, 2-4-3-3 mean kids, where some of the most fierce debates that I ever watch are fighting it out to who's going to be 3-3 versus 2-4.
You gotta end up even.
You know, don't sell your soul or anything. I think that
a soul to sell.
Yeah.
Just qualifies Roy.
This goes back a little bit to Crossex, I guess, but I think that some of the posturing or the imitating of older debaters comes out in the sort of angry aggression in the debates without substance behind it. And I guess I would say one of the things that you need to learn as a sort of building debater, a striving debater, if you will. I just learned this week that we don't call struggling readers struggling anymore. We call them striving readers. So you can be a striving debater. So the striving debaters, what they need to learn how to do is to channel the indignance and the frustration and the six tournaments of being 2-4 instead of 4-2 into specific moments of the debate rather than sort of just this like unbridled angry passion. I think that you'll see that the best debaters do have moments in the debate where they might get angry or might use emotion or might use, you know, some righteous indignance, especially, you know, 2As in the 2AR, got to have a little passion to win the debate. You know, somebody's being mean to your mama, you got to protect her. But the importance of learning...
all of our faces right now. The
importance of learning how to channel that, I think, makes a big difference between the team that ends up 4-2 and the team that ends up 2-4. Picking your battles on that.
Don't let him pick on your mama.
Don't let him pick on your mama.
It's really important.
We're going to talk, I guess...
Scott doesn't give a tip?
Scott's tip is going to be in how to debate the case in the 2AC, but before we talk about that, I just one of the things that I had thought for a while, and I'm not sure if it's still true because I haven't had as much exposure to them as I have in the past, is that debaters that grow up in Missouri or Kansas or... there are other circuits that are sort of just local circuits in other places that would probably fit the same mold. But the debaters that grow up having to learn how to make arguments in more of a protected environment where they're learning to debate the case and they're learning to debate the stock issues, if they then have the opportunity to move beyond that and sort of pursue national circuit style debate or whatever, in front of expert judges, I think that they have a better foundation for debating and just for refutation than debaters that begin and exclusively compete at a national circuit level. And I think that's true when you watch debates at NFL Nationals, when the teams that are doing the best are sort of clearly just better debaters than some of the debaters that sound real good when they're going fast, but when they have to slow down and just kind of speak to normal people, they lose a lot because they can't really communicate with lay people. They don't really understand their arguments. They just rely kind of exclusively on technique. I feel like
you just like it when people go slow.
Well, I think debaters should be able to go slow and still make intelligent arguments.
Speed is a technique. It's not the only
it's
thing.
It's not an end in itself.
I feel like
it's the only thing.
I blame the critique.
What? That doesn't make any sense.
It does because people use the critique as a crud. Like the one sheet of paper 2NR. Makes everyone's life so much easier.
Consult Japan doesn't do that.
The same thing. Consult Japan is in the same boat as that. I'm saying the one sheet of paper 2NR is what prevents people from having arguments. And Scott was rolling his eyes when I said that, but I think it's like the Cap K generico is like, you know, 50% of the state was 50% of the staple 2NRs, or the Security K, you know, ultimate generic that some of these people rely on, and they're able to like wish that, you know, wish and wash away the app and like just like pull some shenanigans. Like, you can't just do that on the deterrence day in the case. Like, you got to be able to execute. You got to be able to do stuff more. So I think that what Maggie said earlier is definitely true, that I think that if you learn how to debate the dissat and the case really well, you can be a really good debater at everything. But I think that if you start your focus on, like, smoke and mirrors K stuff, then your ability to go for, like, the deterrence DA in the case is, like...
I think there's a little bit more to what Bill's saying there, too, though, that sort of the style of debate. My exposure to, you know, Kansas debate has been relatively limited. Some awesome kids from Blue Valley North and a couple labs. I think that one of the things that I've noticed, at least as a trend among those kids that I've seen, is that at whatever speed they were debating, they were making coherent sentences. And it wasn't just argument, blip, warrant, fragment, sentence, tag, cite. They were actual sentences. And so, you know, some of these debaters are very fast. It's not a question of speed. It's a question of, are you still making sentences? Are you still organizing your thoughts into paragraphs? And I think that, you know, the people who have trouble with that are the same people who can sort of debate but can't write at all, because they can't organize their thoughts into, you know, something more than a fragment.
I don't know. I think you're all kind of, like, nibbling around the edges of what's going on here. But I guess, to me, the reason those kids are good is because they immediately learn that, like, their opinion is not the ultimate arbiter of, like, who wins a debate. They're forced from the get-go to learn judge adaptation, which is, like, the most important skill. So a lot of kids who go to kind of predominantly national circuit programs, they're never told you shouldn't do that, or you can't do that, or the judge isn't going to like that, or you can't read that argument. And so they think that they just, like, debate is all about them getting up and saying what they want to say, how they want to say it. And in reality, the debate is about adopting the perspective of whatever specific individual is judging you, picking the arguments that are going to be most persuasive to them, and presenting them in the manner that's most persuasive to them. So it's not so much they went slow or they went fast. It's that they were forced to operate outside of what they thought and think about what other people were thinking. And that's, I mean, even just among people who only do national circuit debate, the people who understand that different judges see things differently and then adapt do a lot better than the ones who don't. And so if you don't learn about judge adaptation until much later on, you're obviously going to be disadvantaged, where, you know, if you're someone who debates in an area where, you know, the judges only really like kind of traditional debate, and that's not what you like from the get-go, you have to change what you're saying if you want to win. And learning to change what you're going to say to win is, like, the most important thing that you can do to get better at debate.
Yep. Very well said. How about this? Let's talk about how to adapt to judges when you're debating the case in the 2AC. You posted about this a couple weeks ago. We talked about it a little bit on the podcast. But there's been a little bit more discussion debating the case in the 2AC.
Okay, so a couple of things that I wanted to mention about this. First is that I don't understand how embedded clash became like a four-letter word. And it seems like everybody is constantly complaining about this and they don't like it. And just listening to it, it seems a lot like people who complain about the offense-defense paradigm, in that they've taken like the worst example of it and they now identify that with the whole thing. And it's like, you can't make rules like that. We can't make traffic laws based on how Gary Busey drives. It doesn't make any sense. You have to make them for the average driver. And so, a lot of times, people think embedded clash just means, like, no signposting. Because that's what bad people who do embedded clash do. But in debating debating the case in the 2AC is an excellent time to do embedded clash. And for two reasons. One is that the 1NC structure is already established. So, for example, doing embedded clash in the 2AC, you maybe have, like, 5 to 8 arguments. You go down the list with embedded clash. People who are poor at embedded clash, like, use it in the 1AR on the politics disad when there was, like, 40 arguments in the 2NC, and then they decide to randomly skip around just using embedded clash without any other attempt to signpost. That does get very confusing. But if the 1NC on your hegemony advantage is, like, first, hegemony is unsustainable. Second, the transition won't be violent. Third, hegemony causes prolif. Four, hegemony causes terrorism. You could, in the go, you know, 1NC1, sustainability, and start making your arguments. But if at the top of the case you just say, hegemony is sustainable, judges are going to know what you're talking about. If you then move on and say, transition is violent, that's very clear. You don't need to do any other signposting to say what's going on there. Versus, you know, in the politics disad and the 1AR, if the 2AC4 is uniqueness, and you start off at the top of the disad by saying, won't pass, and then, like, jump into it, that's going to be more confusing. So, in this instance of debating the case where the 1NC has a clearly established structure, embedded clash is, I think, very important and efficient. So that's one. You should do embedded clash, and, you know, you should also group arguments together. So if they read three cards about sustainability, you know, grouping those together in your embedded clash is fine. But grouping arguments not about sustainability, you know, that's going to screw up your embedded clash, obviously. Second, any argument that you didn't read a card on in the 1AC, you have to read a card. If you don't read a card, you're not winning your advantage. So, for example, in the climate instance, if the NAG reads a card that says climate will occur at night and there's no impact to night warming, if you don't read a card in your 1AC that talks about night warming and you don't read a card in the 2AC, you've lost your climate advantage because they've read an impact defense card that says there will be no impact to climate that your authors don't specifically respond to. So a lot of people think the 2AC on the case is just like blow through it, and it is blow through it when they make arguments that you've already read evidence that responds to. But that requires you to, A, have read like a well-constructed, thought-out advantage, and B, to have highlighted your evidence in such a manner that you're actually reading the warrants and the multiple arguments contained in that evidence, not just the loss of leadership, nuclear exchange portion of the Kalzog card. So combining those two things means that if you're giving a 2AC to that hegemony advantage, 1NC that I just listed, you know, sustainability, maybe you didn't read a card on that. So you need to say hegemony, sustainable, card, read it. Transition violent, you probably read an impact card about that. So you could say, transition is violent, power vacuums, explain warrant, that's Kagan. Now they read turns, proliferant terrorism. Unless you read a proliferant terror impact in your 1AC, you need to read a card. And a laundry list impact card like Thayer doesn't cut it, because whatever card they read probably gave some kind of warning. It didn't just list, you know, prolif as one of many things that hegemony could cause. So you need to read a piece of evidence that either says there's no impact to prolif, hegemony solves prolif, hegemony doesn't spur prolif, one of those things. Same with terrorism. You may have read a generic piece of evidence in your 1AC that responds to the idea that collapse of leadership would solve terrorism and says that resentment is inevitable. So you can extend that warrant, but you also need to read a piece of evidence that says, you know, there's no impact to terrorism, hegemony solves it or whatever, or that's going to outweigh the rest of your kind of abstract hegemony advantage. So if they read evidence, that's kind of the things that you need to do there. If they point out an analytic hole, like Batterman was talking about in this debate from Sanford, if you don't have extension evidence that responds or resolves that analytic hole, you better be impact turning the politics disad, because otherwise you're not winning your advantage and you don't have any offense left in the debate. So you can't just skip over analytic arguments and just, like, you know, fire off a rapid analytic of your own if that's going to be a major problem for you. The flip side of that, though, is, you know, let's say you did read a well-developed hegemony advantage that had like six or seven impacts about why a decline in leadership would be bad, and they read one like Connery 97 card about why leadership is ineffective. Now, that's an instance where you don't need to spend a lot of time. Or if you read a really well-developed warming advantage and they just said, you know, eco-doomsaying is bad, you know, you don't need to spend a lot of time on that. You just need to say that's naysaying and move on. It's like the flip side of their argument. So you don't need to spend a lot of time on those things, but you need to understand where you can and can get away with not spending a lot of time on it. So using embedded clash and figuring out where you need to read evidence, I think, are the two most important parts of the case. Some other kind of minor things. I hate the 2AC overview on the case
that's
page.
That's
terrible.
Okay, the first, the worst kind of overview is the they've missed the boat, here's the five most important arguments we'll win the debate on overview, okay? Because if it is true that the negative has not fully realized what's going on in your case, why would you want to start the speech off with, like, if you want to win, here's some things you should address in the block? Okay, that never made any sense to me, and it's just so stupid. Second, I really hate the, like, minute plus impact overview about the case, where it's like, we read a laundry list impact card, now I'm going to explain to you why all of those things are extinction, and why all of those things are fast, and why all of those things are probable, okay? If you read a hegemony advantage, and they read, you know, the midterms disad with, like, an October surprise impact, okay? What you need to be thinking about before the 2AC is, what is the 2AR going to be on why the disad does not outweigh the case? And if that's the case, the negative is going to make a time frame argument, and you're going to have to make some argument that counters time frame. So instead of reading your same stock overview all the time, set that up in the 2AC and say, look, October surprise may result in a short-term risk of conflict in the Middle East. However, there's a long-term and much more probable risk of conflict if we don't have hegemony, And that occurs over a longer period of time. So possibility of war for 1 week is outweighed by higher possibility of war for many years. Okay, and that's the kind of impact analysis. Even me talking very slowly and not really well, you know, explaining the warrant of that, already better than 99% of 2AC overviews on the case. So it doesn't take a lot, but just doing something like that is substantially better. The last thing I hate, and this is something that was brought up on the thing, is like, we had 7 pages of case, the negative read a dump on one page, now I'm going to go to all the other pages that were in the 1AC. Okay, 2AC time is precious. You don't need to go to the other pages. Each transition takes 2 or 3 seconds, then you have to talk there, then you have to transition to another page, okay? Just say on the dissad or something, say they conceded X advantage, the impact is Y, it outweighs the dissad. There's no need to go to those pages. There's especially no need to go to like multiple pages that they didn't respond to, especially if like you have 5 advantages all based on boosting economic growth and the negative only reads solvency arguments that the plan will not boost economic growth. Okay, wasting time pointing out all the sweet impacts to growth accomplishes nothing if you don't win that you solve it. So just spend your time on solvency. And kind of the last related thing to that that drives me up the wall is I don't really care what you call the advantages in the 1AC. In the 1AC, you call it hegemony leadership. In the 1NC, when they gave their order, all the judges labeled it hegemony because that's what they called it. Don't give your 2AC order and use the original names that you gave in the 1NC. Hegemony leadership, those are pretty similar. But like, if you have multiple impacts to one page and one impact is China and one is India, and you like calling it India, but the 1NC called it China, it's China for the rest of the debate. So give an effective roadmap on the case by using the labels the 1NC did and make it clear. Also, don't give like orders that say, the order will be the 1NC order of the case, okay? Roy didn't listen to the 1NC, probably not listening to the 2AC. Telling him the 1NC order is where you're going, certainly not helping him if he was like, you know, debating.
It would actually be really helpful if you gave me the 1NC arguments out loud so that I could start putting at the top of my sheet of paper what I missed.
That's why he really hates embedded.
That's why, the reason I hate embedded clash is because I need to know what the initial argument was for you to respond to. Sometimes it's not clear. I don't disagree with very much. I do think that there are some instances where the 2EC overview on the case are okay, and I think it's like your characterization, it's funny, ha ha ha, that, you know, don't tell them what they need to answer, blah blah blah. There is a situation if like an advantage has 2 internal links or something like that, and all of their arguments answer 1 internal link. I think that pointing that out, you know, at the top, being like, if their argument, let's say it's like a terrorism advantage, and like your evidence is all about like chemical and biological terrorism, they read all of their cards about like no nuclear terrorism. You know, I guess technically in that, if that's their only answers, you would just say that. But if they're like, you know, some answers would be like, none of these answers apply to our CBW that's independent of that, it's conceded, you know, and then kind of go into answer that. Or if you've got 2 scenarios, one is nuclear, one is CBW, be like, this only answers the nuclear component, not our CBW component. I don't know that that's...
I agree that you should definitely do that, but I would put that in the line-by-line.
But I also think that it's nice to have, like, at the top for, like, the judge to kind of, like, you know, be all...
If the judge is someone who's, like, you know, on full tilt poker during the 2AC, so they need to be alerted to when something important is happening, then maybe. I think it's much better to, like, spring that in the 1AR, because if you do it in the 2AC, the 2NC, generally, people, it's, like, a constructive, they can read a bunch of their defense. Whereas in the 1AR, you can really quickly get through an advantage that way with a good time trade-off. And it's tough for the 2NR to be like, here's new cards that answer, you know, CBW terrorism.
No, just say they're out of constructives and then explain your argument. The thing that bothers me the most about case arguments in the 2AC, besides the gigantic overview thing, is that people only debate the claim, they don't debate the warrant for the argument. So if there are, like, 3 cards that hegemony is unsustainable... no one ever knows what the warrant for any of those arguments are, because instead of saying, you know, they say economy makes it unsustainable, here's our response to that, they just say it's sustainable and read some cards or reference some 1AC evidence without explaining anything. And then the problem, though, is that the neg never really extends any of their distinct arguments either, and so the debate is just like, yes, hedge is sustainable versus no, hedge is not sustainable. But at no point has anyone actually made an argument or, like, argued with the other's position. And
yeah, that's exactly what I mean. Like, you need to read a new card. Like, you may have read a card in your 1AC that's, like, economically hegemony and sustainable, but when they read a card that's, like, the public won't support engagement, yes, you've read a card about sustainability in the abstract, but if you don't read a new card that the public will put up with hegemony, you've lost your hegemony advantage, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think the other thing that I guess you obviously, this would not apply to, but it seems like for a lot of judges, they're very unwilling to apply the kind of you need to win all components of your advantage in order to win your advantage test, such that if you know the negative wins, it's not sustainable because of public support or fatigue, whatever, or it's not sustainable because of some other reason, that the AFL will win some of their advantage, even though the negative has won, that hegemony is unsustainable. And it just doesn't make sense to me that we kind of, it's like the fallacy of the golden mean, where the AF says, we win 100%, and the neg says, no, you win 0%, and the judge is like, 50%.
I think we just went cross-eyed.
I wasn't listening. Tell me about golden...
The fallacy of the golden mean.
The golden ticket.
If you were negative, let's say that you were the 2N, in the 2NR, kind of how would you suggest framing a case flow where you're going for like your dissent in the case, and you want the judge not to just to assign, you know, a little bit less than 100% of their advantage, but that, you know, they have not read a card that answers this argument, they should get 0% of their advantage. How do you frame that in a way that's more palatable to judges other than you and me, I guess?
Well, if you're prepping anyone other than me and Bill, you're obviously making a colossal blunder. But, I mean, I think, like, basically what's going on is that judges kind of, you know, maybe subconsciously, but just kind of, like, from, you know, repetition and habit, I think, are interpreting hegemony, unsustainable public support as kind of like a long-term, like, defensive argument. So it's like, oh, well, maybe they don't preserve hegemony indefinitely, but they still do something. So doing something is still better than doing nothing in that instance. And so, you know, this is kind of where, like, I think, like, misapplication of the offense-defense paradigm comes up. It's like, you don't have hegemony offense, so the AF wins some risk of hegemony. And it's like, that makes sense to a certain extent, but your offense is the dissent, whatever the dissent is. So, yes, the affirmative wins something of hegemony, maybe, but it's not enough to outweigh the dissent, basically. So, I guess how I would frame it is I would say, you know, look, hegemony is not a linear impact. There's some threshold below which we are no longer we're not able to do the things their impact evidence assumes the U.S. as a hegemon will do to reduce the likelihood of conflict. The affirmative may withdraw from Afghanistan, resolving overstretch, but that doesn't mean the public is going to support using those resources to now do something else to manage conflict. And so the affirmative, you know, you can use the language of necessary but not sufficient if you want, or link threshold. They're all kind of getting at the same question, which is, you know, many things need to occur for the affirmative hegemony impact to happen, and the affirmative doesn't get there. They don't do all of those things. So I would then say, you know, look, this is essentially impact probability question. The probability of the dissad is, you know, of a different magnitude than the probability of the case. It's a higher order issue, and so, you know, you'll probably resolve that they win some risk of the case, but that risk of the case is not meaningful when you make your decision.
Anybody else have any thoughts on debating the case?
I thought that the first part, well, one part of a while ago when Scott talked about knowing, making sure that your 1AC is well put together to answer the case arguments. And I think that the problem when we give this advice is, like, we're going to see, like, half the people, like, have a really poor 1AC and just extend random cards and it won't get the job done. And then it'll be like, but we listened to you all and this is what you said to do. It's like, you need to make sure that your 1AC is well constructed to be able to go through that. And then you don't have to read cards, right? Like, if your 1AC has built-in responses to, like, certain turns, then if that is the case, you can extend those pieces of evidence, give the warrant, and move on. But you need to know where your 1AC is strong and where your 1AC is weak. It seems like people, 2AC, just pick up, like, an argument on the case that they're going to read cards on without really thinking about, do I need to really need a card? But it's just like, well, they read 15 cards on the case, so obviously I need to read a card on this card here, right? It's like, that process is not well thought out, so it's like...
Yeah, what Roy just said there, people use, like, straight-up, like, numbers to decide where to read a card. So it's like, they read 6, terrorists won't use nukes card, so I have to read a card there, instead of thinking about, like, what is the actual argument. That is, like, probably the smartest thing Roy has ever said. It's like, reading a bunch of cards on an issue does not necessitate reading a card in response. It's the quality of the evidence read, like, what the arguments are. Sorry, continue.
Well, ultimately,
he's going out on a high note. It's showmanship.
If that's the smartest thing I've ever said, I'm going to retire.
He's retired.
I have one of these a week, really, but it's just...
The thing I always tell debaters, and it just seems so hard for people to understand, is that the evidence that ultimately decides an issue where there's actually a controversy is the best piece of evidence on the AF side and the best piece of evidence on the NAEP side. It's very rarely the second, third, or fourth best piece of evidence on either side. If the best piece of evidence that you've got can't beat their argument, then reading two more cards that aren't as good as your best card is not going to help you. There are a few exceptions, I guess, on issues like politics, uniqueness, or whatever, where in reality all the cards are horrible. But on a substantive issue where you sort of, you know, is nuclear terrorism likely or not, you know, the judge is ultimately deciding your best argument versus their best argument and who wins that. And so I think that teams would be much better served if they read longer, better cards, maybe make a bigger deal about qualifications or about context or whatever, so that the one best piece of evidence that they're handing the judge at the end of the debate is actually a good piece of evidence, as opposed to just being like, well, we read five cards, so the judge is obviously going to decide that we were right because we got five cards and they only got three cards or whatever. But it's not, very few judges, and no judges that sort of know what they're doing, decide it based on quantity.
It also helps your ethos if you're willing to be like, to just like say, they read six pieces of nuclear terrorism, our X piece of evidence is better than all of their piece of evidence for four reasons, we don't need to read another card. You know?
Yeah,
I think that helps you rather than you re-engaging in, you know, four more cards on this. It's like, we got one card, it's better than every card they're ever going to read on this issue, this is why, move on.
I think, like, you know, over the last couple of years, all the files that I've turned out, the cards have gotten kind of progressively longer, but there are much less of them. And I guess, like, debaters just kind of, like, don't get it. I remember there was a debate recently where the team that I was coaching, before the debate, I was like, you're going to read this K, they're going to go for Realism Inevitable, make sure you read this one card. It's like a page and a half long, just read it. And they're like, okay, got it, check. And then after the round, I'm like, what happened? They're like, oh, we lost on Realism Inevitable. You know, we read these like 15 cards, but the other team's card was better. And I was like, did you read the page long card? And they're like, well, no, if we had read that, we would have only gotten to read one. And it's like, I don't know of any judge who at the end of the round, like, tally marks up the number.
On the Realism Inevitable debate, it's an evidence number issue there.
Or anything. I mean, it's just like one big good card beats four short crappy cards every time, unless one of the short crappy cards makes like an entirely separate argument. That's an instance where you have to read a different card, but just in general, you know, like winners win versus political capital finite. Reading one card that really explains the argument is going to be better than reading like six, you know, two sentence Ormskin cards.
I definitely think that something that you all talked about earlier though does resonate a little bit in that there are some instances where judges just like are willing to give the team like the benefit of the doubt. Like if, you know, it's like how much is there like really zero risk of the uniqueness, you know, like the zero versus not zero. And I know that I've done it in some debates where it's like, you know, the negative is winning a whole bunch on the, you know, like a big old case, you know, defense arc, you know, a bunch of case defense marks, maybe some turns there. And then I'm like, yeah, might be ahead on the uniqueness, you know, a little bit, but it's like, I think that debaters doing a better job of impacting that, kind of like why their evidence means that you shouldn't assess that, is where that comes into play a little bit more. Because I think what ends up happening is that we read the cards, and it's like, it might be a little bit more clear, but no one has kind of done that articulation of why that means I should assess. And I think that goes back to one of like the first three in our post about like impacting your analytical arguments or impacting your like arguments a little bit better in terms of what this means for how we should evaluate the debate and not just, you know, first step, making the argument, next step, what that means for how we should evaluate. Like, if you've got a devastating, you know, answer to their laundry list card, just making that is one thing, but then saying how that means I should evaluate the warming debate is the next step in kind of doing that better, because then it becomes a little bit tougher for judges to figure out what they're supposed to do with that argument.
This goes back to debating the case a little bit, but I think that two A's also need to do a little bit more backwards planning and think about what arguments they need to win the advantage for the 2AR and then get those cards back into the 1A seat. I think that the 2A's that struggle with debating the case are either the ones that read the, you know, three-card warming advantage and then have to debate a bunch of defense and have to do exactly what Scott just said, you know, read a card on each one of those issues, which is obviously the thing you have to do in that debate. But once you've had that debate where all of a sudden you have to read 10 cards in the 2A seat or kick the advantage because you have no choice, I think that the more long-term thinking there is maybe I need to be reading longer cards in the 1A seat. Maybe I need to be reading cards that answer Nightwarming or that answer, you know, whatever issue it is that you had to read cards on in the 2A seat. And I think that sometimes the 1A seat cards tend to be too heavily weighted toward impacts and not enough, nearly enough, weighted toward the internal link arguments that, frankly, you'll probably have to read a card on in the 2A seat. And so it's worth just sort of keeping track over the course of a tournament of what case arguments do people go for, and when people are extending case arguments, which arguments did I have to read in the 2AC, and can I get that card into the 1AC instead of, you know, the third impact to, I don't know, war with North Korea?
Yeah, I think that's something that I talked with our debaters with the, today, is just about changing the 1AC from tournament to tournament to reflect what arguments teams are going for against you, and which places the 2AC is needing to read cards, which places the 2A is a little weaker. And I see so many teams that just read the same 1AC from like tournament to tournament to tournament. And it's like you've got the same 1AC from Camp to Green Hill to St. Mark's. And it seems very unlikely that that 1AC, the sort of first version, has kind of all the right choices about what to include in the 1AC and how many cards on each issue, how long of cards on each issue. And it's silly, especially when the 2A kind of in every debate has this like list of four or five must-read cards that they read in every 2AC. It's like, why don't you put those in the 1AC and then take out some of the cards that you never extend?
If I could just like real quick add one thing to that, is that it really seems stupid to me, teams that read these kind of like, you know, I guess like poorly screwed together like six advantages with a bunch of different impacts. Okay, if you read like six advantages, one of which is hegemony, and you know you're debating a team that only goes for the deterrence disad, the way you should alter your 1AC is to remove the hegemony advantage so you can then read impact defense to the deterrence disad that doesn't contradict your 1AC advantage claims. Or if you know that a team always goes for a politics disad that impacts in growth, don't read a growth advantage so that you can then read defense to that. Mm-hmm. So it's not even just like tournament to tournament. It's like round to round, what are you likely to hear from the other team? You know, so if you generally read a stupid terrorism causes extinction impact, and now you know that you're debating a team that likes to go for a K, you know, read a less radical impact about why alienating, you know, Muslim populations is a bad idea.
Yeah, I don't know. That's one thing that totally boggles my mind when teams debate on the F against K teams, and they know that the team's going to go for the K, and everyone knows the team's going to go for the K, and they still include all of these arguments in the 1AC that are just like blatant links that they don't have any defense of. And then maybe they add like a couple of pragmatism cards or something.
Krishna
all
about it.
Krishna all about it. It's like, what are you thinking?
But the opposite is also kind of a problem where it's like, oh my god, we're debating K team, better take out all of the impacts.
2 minute
1AC. And now we haven't said anything that we can possibly defend. I think that, you know,
people always say that. They're always like, I'm a K team, and I love it when the other team takes their impacts out.
No, they don't.
I don't get that at all. But we always used to do that when we debated Ks and just be like, economic growth makes puppies sad. And it's like the other team would have... I don't understand. Well, how does it hurt you when you take out your extreme impacts and read a moderate impact?
Lots of times they don't take out the extreme impact and read the moderate impact. They just basically don't say anything. It's like, we should pull out of Afghanistan because we should.
It's not about the impact. It's the way in which you look at the world, Scott, is the problem.
We should withdraw from Afghanistan because in Afghanistan we like drink soda and aluminum cans are bad.
Yeah.
Okay, now what does the K team say that outweighs that?
The
AF
is not
link?
Prepared to defend any of those claims. It's like, what?
Defend versus what? The K of aluminum soda? I don't understand.
Yes, 3-0 neg. No, I just mean that I think that a lot of times AFs would be better picking something that they can defend and learning to defend it than running away and thinking that they can take out anything that's objectionable. I think that, especially given the literature that people are reading this year, it's not just the impacts that link. And, you know, a lot of the way that your authors have framed the 1AC, even if the impact is, you know, we kill puppies in Afghanistan, the rest of your authors are definitely making arguments that link to the K. And so you want to be thinking about what can we defend here as opposed to what can we run away from.
Well, no. Your point makes sense if you substitute an advantage like hegemony that you have realism evidence to defend for like an environment advantage that you then don't have any defense of.
Which is not what I'm saying. Happens all the time. Right. I'm not disagreeing with you necessarily. I think you're disagreeing with me. I think that...
What? You said K-teams... Teams get hurt when they take things out.
Right, I was
really
saying...
Really what you were saying is...
It is dangerous
when they swap,
to go too far in the other direction to take things out and be left with nothing that you can defend.
Right, but you're only hurt when you insert something that you can't defend.
That's not necessarily true. I think that there are lots of parts of the 1AC that still link, but you haven't made an impact claim. Like, you don't even get the benefits of being able to say realism anymore because you haven't made a realist impact claim.
But you don't...
Well,
link.
No, first of all, no negative... In high school has ever said that you don't get to make a realism argument even if you're not realist. But that is a way too high-tech argument for any K debater in high school, that the app is not in fact realist.
Yeah, please do that.
I guess I don't understand. The nothing to defend assumes you're Wayne versus some offense the neg has won. But if you've removed the objectionable portions...
Because I don't think that given the nature of many of these affirmatives and the way that they are set up that you can remove all objectionable portions.
I could not disagree. I mean, what better AF would you like to defend versus a K than remove troops who are, like, killing civilians?
If your advantage is remove troops that are killing civilians, if your advantage is remove troops, you know, that have hegemony because of hegemony, and then your impact to hegemony is, like, we can have soft power and help people withdraw medicine, I mean, that's still linked.
That's not what Bill and I are saying. We're saying remove the hegemony. The whole part
okay,
of the
AF
strategy.
Right, and I'm saying that I think a lot of times, the more moderate version of the AF, affirmative debaters need practice defending, or they sound more stupid defending the moderate version of the AF than they would have just defending the hard-led version.
I mean...
I don't know if I agree with that, but I understand what she's saying.
Well, yes, this is now something totally different than what we were initially talking about, but I guess sounds stupid.
If you're going to defend, if you have a terrorism impact, and you're going to need to defend against the security K, and you know that they're going to read some terror critique arguments. You can be prepared to defend terrorism, but it doesn't make any sense to read Corsi or like some racist person.
Yeah.
Just read a card that read a card that defends the claim. Like we just got this new book, which is pretty cool, from Robert Pape from the University of Chicago about suicide terrorism. He and some co-author wrote an update to one that they had done many years ago, but you could read a card from that that's like, this is based on a scientific study, here's the root cause of terrorism, is military presence or whatever. Read that, and then the K-team is actually kind of has to answer something instead of just being like, haha, your author is an idiot and obviously racist and inflammatory. Because there are so many
statistics are racist.
Statistics are racist and inflammatory, and only white people can understand that.
Well, no, I know from experience, statistics are biased against white people.
Against white people?
At least the statistics classes that I have.
I think that we'll do the CrossFit
at some point.
At some point. We'll tease it.
We're teasing it.
We're
at a future point, and this has been in the works for a while.
At any given point, as early as tomorrow.
There could be a post about CrossFit, which is an exercise/fitness regime. Or program, or however, whatever you want to say, that Roy has been partaking in for a while to dramatic effect. But he has some good ideas about how to apply the lessons of CrossFit and his weight loss fitness thing to debate, and he's been promising that he's going to do this forever. So now that this is officially on the 3NR podcast as a tease, hopefully he will be motivated to actually do it.
As early as tomorrow.
We really should keep a running count. We should figure out when the last Roy Levkovitz 3NR post was.
Well, post or comment response?
Post.
It might be a year at this point.
No, that's not that.
Right,
not that
I mean, point. After the TOC, you posted.
I think the TOC should
have. Posted a shout-out. That's all we've gotten from him.
That's a good count.
I've been busy since May.
Yeah, I mean, busy losing weight and learning about how to apply the... Lessons of CrossFit.
We've lost all momentum.
Let's
wrap this up. This is horrible. Next week, maybe we'll talk about how to brainstorm.
No, we'll talk about St. Mark's next week.
Specific picks. We might talk about recommendation counterplans.
We definitely won't. Don't even get your hopes up.
We might talk about those. Scott, good or bad? Just to tease it.
Bad.
Okay, good. I thought you might be going crazy. They're definitely bad. And if you have suggestions for other topics of conversation,
please
feel free to post.
I'll check them out.
But otherwise, for the 3NR, I am Bill Batterman with
Scott Phillips,
Maggie Berthew,
Roy Lefkowitz. She wasn't sure about her last name.
I wasn't sure he was pointing to me.